The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Wheelock, and Judge Cochran. The Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Court of Appeals, January 25. A bit balmy compared to a week ago when we were presiding, so we'll take it. We are live streaming and recording the proceeding as well, and so we do ask counsel that when you approach the podium, you do identify yourself for our record, who you represent. The podium, as you may know, has a button to go up or down to suit your most comfortable spot, and the clock timer is on there as well, so we do ask you to keep an eye on that, too. Our first case of four that we have scheduled today for oral argument, A23-1121, Ronald Lindsay Reed is the appellant, Minnesota Department of Corrections at all respondents. And so, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may approach, identify yourself, and begin.
Good morning. My name is Zach Longsdorf. I represent appellant Ronald Reed. I just want to let you know up front, I apologize for the quality of my voice. I had COVID about 2 weeks ago, and I'm back in business, but my voice has not responded along with the rest of me.
It sounds pretty good from here. So,
thank you. An ex post facto challenge related to parole eligibility requires determining if the regulations create a sufficient risk of increasing the measure of punishment for the covered crimes. An ex post facto violation can be shown by evidence drawn from the rule's practical implementation by the agency charged with exercising discretion that its retroactive application will result in a longer period of incarceration than under the other earlier rule. To make that determination, the court should compare the current parole laws with those in effect at the time of the offense. The general idea here, going all the way back to Bailey v. Gardebring, in 1991 seems to be that because granting parole was discretionary in 1970 and because it's still discretionary now, that there can be no ex post facto violation. I don't think that that analysis ends with the same conclusion when the changes that have occurred since 1991 are factored in. Now, I understand that changing the decision maker and then lessening the frequency of the hearings have been challenged in the past, and the courts like the Eighth Circuit in Bailey have said that these are procedural changes and they don't constitute ex post facto violations.
Mr. Longsdorf, before you get too far into that, I have a question kind of related to that general. That seems to be the crux of your client's concern is the changes, whether they're procedural or not. I realize that's the point you were about to get to. Somehow makes it more likely, less likely that he'd be granted parole at an earlier time. Is that a fair summary of kind of the backdrop of his entire concern here?
Exactly, Your Honor.
If that's true, that just strikes me, and respondent made this point, I think, in a few spots in its brief, that's so speculative. Tell me why that is not a speculative, because I assume your client would have to agree you really don't know because you're not operating under those, and yet that's really a hope. I think the Supreme Court uses the phrase a mere hope or a possibility anyway, but isn't that true that that's largely a speculative concern?
I don't think that it is speculative in this case, and I do think that the extra time really here is present on its face. If we look at what the ACC did, based on the few materials that we have, which respondent provided, essentially what they say they were doing is we look at the offender and then we ask, is it safe to release him? And if we release him, can he be in society and pull his weight? And if the answer to both of those questions is yes, then the ACC back in the 70s using those criteria would grant parole as soon as possible. Now, with Reed, we know the answer to both of those.
So it would grant parole? I thought the statute was discretionary, you know, the earlier statute was discretionary as well. So what basis is there for your assertion that the ACC would grant parole?
Well, the basis for the reason we believe that the ACC would grant parole is that they essentially listed those as the two criteria in the pamphlet that was provided by the respondent. If we look at Reed, this case is a little bit unique in that the offense was in 1970, but Reed wasn't arrested and charged until 2005. Now, he did some time in Nebraska in the 70s up until 1985, but between 1985 and his arrest in this case, Reed was a law-abiding citizen, no arrests, no issues with law enforcement. He came to Minnesota willingly when law enforcement wanted to talk to him. We also know that we believe that the mental health and corrections professionals in the facility that Reed was dealing with said he's ready for release and that he's got a very low MnSTAR score. But because of this time between 1985 and 2005, we know the answer to both of the questions about Reed in a way that I don't think we would about really any other offender, which is yes, he can be in society safely because he was for 20 years, and yes, that he can carry his own weight or fulfill his obligation because he had done so, and under the 1970s decision-making criteria, then the ACC would view that as its obligation is to grant release as soon as he satisfies those obligations.
Is it true, to follow up Judge Cochran's question, though, that the part of your client's petition did include any actual statistical comparison of first-time parolees and percentage that were granted versus in a more under the current statutory regime?
It is true that we don't have that information, and it wasn't included in Mr. Reed's materials. So part of getting back to the other question from Judge Cochran is it was discretionary in 1970, and it remains discretionary now, but I think if we look at it, it's less discretionary now than it was in 1970. And the reason for that is because we've got the statutes which started in, I think, 1994, and basically what they said is that the decision maker now has for the very first time criteria that it has to consider when deciding whether to grant release. And the criteria are now, essentially for the first time starting in 1994, that the decision maker has to seek out the opinions of and give weight to the desires of victims, law enforcement, prosecutors, and sentencing judges. And now those are groups that I think are uniformly going to be against granting release. And so while it remains discretionary to grant release for the commissioner, which is not the same decision maker, it's less discretionary because now there are actual criteria that the decision maker has to consider when granting release, and they're, I think, against granting release. Now, I agree, I guess there's an idea that the decision maker certainly could have considered factors like these prior to 1994 at any time, and I think that's accurate, but it is also accurate that the decision maker would not have had to prior to 1994, but now the decision maker must do that, and I think that's what makes this case different and better suited for relief than earlier cases in which the only change was to the decision maker and the frequency of the hearings. And I think that that takes this outside of the idea that these are just procedural changes, and it gets into changing the substance of how these decisions are made. And if we look at, there's a Morales case cited in the district court's materials, and there the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, essentially says, well, if there are procedural changes, then we don't have an ex post facto violation, but then notes, if it got into the substance of it, we might. And I think what this does is it gets us into the substance of it in a way that we hadn't before. So even though whether to grant release is still discretionary, I think it's now less discretionary because even though the decision maker might still say I can do whatever I want and make the decision however I want, the legislature has essentially said, not so fast, you need to talk to these groups and give their opinions weight. And I don't think that there's anything that anyone can point to that says that this was the case at the time of Mr. Reed's offense, because I think it was truly discretionary back in the 1970s and now in 1994, in addition to changing the decision maker, which happened a couple times, changing the frequency of the hearings, we now have to consider these factors. And that is, I think, what makes this an ex post facto violation in a way that other claims haven't been.
Do you have any case law that you're relying on for the argument that less discretionary is a basis upon which we can deem it an ex post facto law?
I don't have a piece of case law that specifically says that thing, but what we're basing it on is if you look at, like, the Morales decision or even that Bailey v. Gardebring from 1991, is those courts are kind of breaking them up into procedural changes and then what would be substantive changes, and then the courts are distinguishing and saying, well, if it's just the decision maker, that's merely procedural. And if it's merely changing the time, that's procedural. And, you know, then they mention if it was substantive, then they can get into whether or not it's going to be an ex post facto violation if it is a substantive change, and I think this is. And then that's where we get into having to look at is, in fact, and the way this is working in purpose and in reality causing the inmate to serve more time. And I think I covered that already, but we view it as Mr. Reed is, because under the 70s standards, based on the evidence that's available for 20 years, he would be released.
And Mr. Langsdorf, your client's due process claim, since it's relying on Taylor, it's based on the U.S. Constitution, not the Minnesota Constitution, correct?
I think I agree with that decision.
Okay. And in your rebuttal, your reply to the respondent's brief, you question the argument that Taylor's no longer good law. But my question is this: if it's based on Taylor, and Taylor clearly identified the liberty interest based on that Nebraska Greenholz case on the 14th Amendment, and the U.S. Supreme Court overruled or reversed that means the 14th Amendment no longer provides your client with a liberty interest. Isn't that correct? In other words, the Minnesota Supreme Court doesn't need to overrule itself for that decision, which was based on the 14th Amendment, of which the U.S. Supreme Court now spoke, to no longer be good law.
Well, I think that's, if the premise is accurate, that if Taylor isn't good law, then I don't think Reed has a valid due process claim. The way we are viewing this is that the Minnesota Supreme Court, I don't think, said that Greenholz is binding precedent and we have to follow it no matter what. And the way I read that case is they reviewed it, adopted it, and said this is what our rule is going to be, and therefore the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Greenholz doesn't have the effect of automatically overturning the Minnesota Supreme Court. And if, in fact, Taylor is good law, then I think Reed may have a valid claim, because we've got all of these factors, which is, back then it was the ACC. He gets one-year hearings. The hearings are recorded and put in the file. The ACC makes the decision. The things the ACC considers is whether the offender can be released safely, and if so, does it. Now we've got the commissioner making the decision. The reviews are farther apart. The decision maker is statutorily mandated to consider factors that weren't. And so if Taylor is a good law, then Reed, I think, has a valid claim. And I do think that really the validity of Taylor is the issue here. And the kind of the basis I have is I followed the cases through that cited and after it, and I haven't seen the Minnesota Supreme Court reverse itself. And so I do think that is still potentially good case law, and if that's the case, it would be binding on the district court and this court, and I think Reed has a valid claim.
And to the extent, would you agree that, again, looking at U.S. constitutional law, because there appeared to be no case that I saw in the briefs, and I'm not aware of one that actually directly or solely looks at the Minnesota Constitution, the equivalent liberty of the Due Process Clause, you concede in your briefing that the description of minimal process applies. So what part of the process that your client had here, what specifically was missing to get to the minimal?
Sure, and I think that dovetails a little bit with the substantive due process claim here, because one of the things that the substantive due process does is it essentially protects against arbitrary decisions. And the way we have presented this and the way we view it is that by adding in these additional factors and essentially making it so that the reason Reed is denied relief is that he hasn't shown sufficient remorse that the legislature has made this from sort of an, it's close to an objective decision as we can have based on offender concerns, people who've worked with the offender in the facility, and they've made it so that the reason he's denied relief is remorse, and remorse isn't something that we can measure in any meaningful way. There's no...
I'm sorry to interrupt, but you say that the reason he was denied relief was related to remorse or an insufficient showing of remorse. I have the letter here that the Department of Corrections sent to Mr. Reed, and so your reading of that letter is that the denial was related to remorse or an insufficient showing of remorse?
That is correct, Your Honor, and part of that is based on what Reed himself was informed at the... They have a hearing. The commissioner comes in and talks to him briefly, goes and talks to a bunch of other people, comes back, and then spent a few moments telling Reed, you know, why he's got to come back in a few years, and one of the reasons was he didn't think there was sufficient remorse or that it was genuine. And just to sum up the substantive due process, we view that as it's arbitrary. Reed can't measure it. Really, there's no way for him to know what he can do to get himself closer to release in the future, and therefore it makes it an arbitrary decision. Thank you.
Very well, you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal as well. Counsel for respondent, when you're ready, you may approach, identify yourself, and then begin.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. I'm Assistant Attorney General Elizabeth Johnston. I represent the respondent in this matter, the Commissioner of the Department of Corrections. Mr. Reed was convicted of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder and aiding and abetting premeditated first-degree murder related to the shooting death of a police officer in 1970. He received the statutorily mandated sentence of life imprisonment. Under the supervised release scheme that was in place in 1970, he may be granted parole in the discretion of the parole authority, who at this point in time is the Commissioner of Corrections. Mr. Reed became eligible for that consideration in 2021. He was considered by the Commissioner, and as was just recounted, and as is noted in the letter that Your Honor referenced, the commissioner determined that parole was not appropriate at that time. The highly discretionary nature of parole, which has been noted here, is well and thoroughly established and recognized. It's right in the statute 243.05 in 1970 and in 2021, today for that matter, may be granted. It's recognized in case law from this court, like Morse. It's in Greenholz from the United States Supreme Court. And it's in so many other cases that I think at least some of which are cited in our brief. Mr. Reed's habeas petition, although it is couched as five separate alleged constitutional violations, really is an attack on that discretion, on that as the scheme for making parole available. He's seeking to create somehow a right to an early release from his life sentence when, in fact, as Greenholz and any number of other cases makes clear, that's just not a right that exists. Mr. Reed clearly wishes that the commissioner had exercised.
You referenced Greenholz. Can we talk about Taylor and Greenholz? I'm not aware of any Minnesota Supreme Court case holding that, you know, essentially declaring that Taylor is no longer good law as a result of Greenholz. Are you aware of any case?
I'm not. I think there are other cases where the Minnesota Supreme Court, like Carrillo, has used Greenholz and has talked about it and certainly hasn't done any distinguishing. But I also think that when the United States Supreme Court makes a broad and blanket statement that there is no fundamental right to the discretionary release from a lawfully imposed sentence. The Minnesota Supreme Court doesn't have to agree or say so explicitly in order for that to nevertheless be something that it is required to abide by.
So as you know, we are generally bound by the Minnesota Supreme Court's mm-hmm. precedent at the Court of Appeals in our decision making. Is it appropriate for this court to state that Taylor has in effect been overruled by Greenholz?
I think it is, and I think Your Honors, in fact, essentially already have. I think in cases like Morse, like any number of other, not all published necessarily, but some of them are cited in our brief cases, this court has already said that there simply is no fundamental right to parole and that it is a discretionary act that may be granted by the identified parole authority.
Counsel, what do you make of the argument that there's highly discretionary and less discretionary? I mean, I think that some of opposing counsel's argument is based on this idea that there's a spectrum of discretion that can be exercised and that imposing the criteria that needed to be considered reduced that somehow.
And I want to speak to a couple of pieces of Your Honor's question. But so initially I would say I think there's discretion. And then there's an abuse of discretion. And I don't think there's a highly discretionary and sort of kind of discretionary. That's not a thing. It is discretionary. The parole authority may grant. There are no, aside from the offender needs to have served the requisite amount of incarceration before he can be considered. But other than that, there are no boundaries placed on the commissioners in this case, the parole authority's ability to make a choice. Beyond the fact that in Minnesota, I mean, there's discretion, then there's an abuse of discretion, and that is a legal standard that we use in lots of circumstances where agencies are afforded just discretion to do things, and it's only if they have acted outside of their authority, made a decision that has no support in the record, acted arbitrarily, which is a legally defined kind of concept, that their decision is called into question. I also wanted to push back a little bit on this notion that somehow there are criteria, and I think that relates to where I started, which was that Mr. Reed is looking to create a checklist, and maybe understandably, he would like to know that if he does A plus B plus C, it will equal release. But that's just not what discretion is. And in the context of a sentence which is for life imprisonment, it's not the two-thirds, one-third thing, it's not a 57 months, it is life, period. Discretion is the bucket that he falls in, and he does not actually have an expectation in anything other than that life sentence and that he be considered. This notion that considering victims or prosecutors or, you know, whatever other information somehow creates criteria, I think is wrong. It does specify that the commissioner should consider it. There is no related language that says, and give it weight. The commissioner doesn't have to give it any weight if he doesn't wish to. It really just moves what already existed in sort of 609.115, which is this gathering of broad information, including about harm and injury to the community, which would include the victim. It's really just moving that into the same location as here's who's considering parole. But that requirement, that information, that breadth of information, along with the fact that the commissioner can do, or the parole authority, I suppose, can do whatever they would like with that information, that's the system that has always existed.
Would you agree, counsel, though, to use the phrase you abuse of discretion, under the current law, would you agree it would be an abuse of discretion to consider parole without reaching out to victim or perhaps a input from law enforcement or the prosecutor involved in the case? Whereas under the old regime, it would not be an abuse not to reach out. So at least that you would concede, that would then be an abuse of discretion now and would not have been under the old regime.
I would concede the first part of Your Honor's question. I do think, though, that if you look back at 609.115 from 1969, 1970, it requires the preparation of this report, including community harm sorts of information, for the purpose of putting it in the prison file so that it can be considered at the time of a parole decision. And so I think there is also an argument that failing to have that report prepared, and in 609.115 it says either the court's probation officer or the commissioner of corrections himself, well, or his department, I suppose, will prepare that report. I think it's going to get there one way or another.
So your point being, it would have been the exact same information then as it would be now, but in a different form?
Yes. And sort of broken up. And actually, the language in 609.115 still exists. It just now is maybe a little more specific, since 1994.
Why add the language if the prior language already required consideration of the victim's perspective?
I think I can only speculate as to why the legislature thought reemphasizing it was an important thing. Maybe they thought it wasn't being accomplished. Not sure. That would be speculative. But the fact remains that that statute, both of those statutes exist, and they provide for the creation and provision of really all the same evidence to the parole authority, and additionally do not require, have never required, and do not now require that any particular weight be assigned to any of the information that is made available to the parole authority. I do want to point to just a couple of things that I heard from counsel's argument. One is somehow this idea that the 1970 version, the ACC, had any particular criteria or sort of checklist. You meet A, you meet B, and we let you out. That's not supported in the record. There is a public-facing brochure, which is addressed to family members, which talks about, we consider lots of things. We want to do right by the community, by the offender. This is not a list of requirements or criteria. It's just not. I also think that the notion that he would be released is a dramatic overstatement because of all the things that we've just talked about, that it is discretionary, it is highly dependent, as Greenholz recognized, on all sorts of subjective factors as well as a broad range of information. And among the things we don't know, because it's not thoroughly in the record, are all of the things that the commissioner considered. We have some description in that letter, and counsel has mentioned some things that actually aren't in the record. But what we know is that the commissioner looked at information, had conversations, including apparently with Mr. Reed, and then made a discretionary decision based on that.
Does the letter explain the reasons for the commissioner's decision to deny parole at that time?
I think it does.
Where do you see that?
I see
a list of things to continue for, working on, but I guess I'm not sure I see the reason for the denial or reasons for the denial.
And so certainly there is not a sentence that begins with parole is denied because, but what it does say is we're grateful for the good things that you have let us know have happened and that we've seen in your file, but also Your depth of self-examination will be integral to your success in achieving the directives you've been given. And then looking back at the directives that are given, they include that Mr. Reed continue to work with mental health professionals and other psychological professionals in doing that level of self-examination. I don't know whether that's remorse. I don't know what that is. But it does say that the commissioner considered psychological and other mental health evaluations and diagnostics, his behavior, treatment progress, a number of things, and that the commissioner is saying, we don't see that enough progress is made there. You need to continue to work on those through these directives. Maybe there should be that sentence, you are denied because, but there are no magic words requirements here. And what we do have is a list, a description of the commissioner saying, I considered these things, and this didn't convince me that now is the time, that right now it is well-balanced, sound, and safe to grant you parole. Unless there are other questions, I'll sit down.
I see none. Very well. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And counsel for appellant, you'll now have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just start out, I would submit that the requirements in 1994 added in statutes 243.05 subdivision 1B and 244.05 subdivision 5 are mandatory and are criteria that the commissioner has to consider and give weight to. If we go to the 243.05 subdivision 1B subsection B, The last sentence says the commissioner must consider the victim's statement when making the parole decision. If we go to 244.05 subdivision 5, subsection B of that says the commissioner shall require the preparation of a community investigation report and shall consider the findings of the report when making a supervised release decision under this supervision. I would submit that this is getting directly and really for the first time, the legislature is getting into changing the substance and not just the procedure of how parole is determined. The U.S. Supreme Court in cases like Morales and I think the Eighth Circuit in cases like Bailey have essentially said, well, if we're dealing with substantive changes in how this is determined instead of just procedural claims, then there can be an ex post facto violation. And that's when we would take the next step and look and see if impractical impact and how these are working, that these statutes do actually cause the petitioner or the inmate to serve additional time. I think this case has a lot of unique factors, including the 35 years between the offense date and Mr. Reed's arrest and prosecution. He had 20 years of demonstrated conduct showing that he is safe to be released, that he can fulfill his obligations. And I think under those circumstances, if we look at what's made available about the parole decisions back at the time of this offense, those are the factors they would give the most weight to, and they're strongly in favor. And therefore, Mr. Reed has satisfied his burden of showing an actual and real effect that he's serving additional time.
How do you get around the law, though, on ex post facto that his sentence has not changed? In other words, that the focus of the ex post facto is essentially a retroactive, if that would change in a sentence, but he has a life sentence. So as the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court said, parole is a, I think the phrase they use is a mere hope or possibility, but the point being is he knows that he's in prison for life. So how can any changes, whether you phrase it as substantive or not, he still has the right to a parole possibility.
Sure, and I think that the U.S. Supreme Court actually distinguishes a little bit in between that. If we look at, for example, I think I just got to find the page that has the case on it. But the case, they say that the factor is when looking at parole eligibility determinations, that if it actually causes a person to serve additional time that they wouldn't under the other rules, it can be a violation. So I don't think that the U.S. Supreme Court has limited ex post facto violations and said that the only way you can have one is if, let's say, and I know you can't do this with the life sentence, but if you had a 10-year sentence that they say, well, now you're going to do 11. I don't think that that's a hard limit, and I think what the Supreme Court has said when it comes to parole, we've just got to look at the practical impact, and I think if we do that here, that Reed has shown that he's served additional time. Absent questions, I don't have anything further.
I see no other questions. Thank you, counsel, and thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today and your briefing. We will not take the matter under advisement. We'll be issuing a ruling within 90 days. You each have a good day.
Thank you.